Parshas Vayikra, starting our third of our five books. So before we get to the main topic that I want to talk about this afternoon, I just have to share two thoughts from the beginning of the parsha. There are certain parshios, certain statements that Chazal make that you just can't give up the opportunity to say something on, even if we've said it in the past. I don't think we have, but it's worthwhile. The beginning is on page 544. The parasha begins, from which the whole sefer gets its name, Vayikra el Moshe. Hashem calls out to Moshe, Vayidaber elav, and Hashem spoke to him from the tent of meeting, saying, and then he goes on to describe what's in the beginning of this week's parasha, which is all about korbanos, the different sacrifices, and there's a long list in the parasha of different categories and circumstances of various sacrifices. And everybody points out these first two phrases would seem to be extraneous, or at least one of them is extraneous. Vayikra el Moshe, Hashem calls out to Moshe, and then it says that Hashem spoke to him from the tent. So that there was apparently, before Hashem actually began to speak to Moshe, there was a kriya, there was a calling out to him. So Rashi comments on this, and Rashi points out, the very first Rashi in the parasha, L'chol dibros, u'l'chol amiros, u'l'chol tzivuyim. All speakings, all commandments, every time Hashem had a communication with Moshe, kadma kriya. Before he began the dialogue, before Hashem began the commandments, whatever it was that he wanted to say to Moshe, before that there was a kriya, there was a calling out to Moshe. The sages describe he would call out to him twice, Moshe, Moshe, and Moshe would answer, Hineni, here I am ready. And then Hashem, after having had that initial dialogue, would then begin whatever it was that he wanted to say to him. Rashi adds this idea of a kriya, of a calling out to Moshe beforehand, is a lashon chiba. It's a language, chiba is a lashon of love, or dearness, closeness. It's a language of bringing close. Moshe, Moshe, where you call out to a person, especially when you use their name, when you call out to them, is a lashon, it's a language of chiba. It's a language of love. It's a language of being dear, being close to the person with whom you want to speak. Rashi comments it's the language that the malachim, the angels, would use as well when they would speak with each other to call out, to give praise together to Hashem. As opposed, Rashi concludes, as opposed to the way that Hashem would address the prophets of the world, the Bilams, the non-Jewish prophets, they were never addressed with this Vayikra. They were never addressed by having themselves been called out to first, but instead the Torah uses other languages which would imply a happenstance or a chance or a temporary calling, a language of impurity. You didn't have that initial language of chiba, of dearness, of closeness, of love in the beginning of the conversation. Adkan, that's what Rashi comments. And it's just worth noting, it's just such an important lesson. It's just so critical, the way we introduce a conversation, the way that we get somebody's attention speaks volumes, both as to what it is that we want to say and the type of relationship we have with the person with whom we're speaking. And if you'll pay attention both to our own lives but also to what goes on around us, You see that, you know, a snap of the fingers to get someone's attention. Horrible. Or a hey you, or all other forms of beginning to address somebody as opposed to calling them by name. It begins the conversation in an entirely different way. One way shows a way of chiba, a way of love, a way of understanding, a connection, a relationship in terms of what I want to say. And when you leave that out, you're starting from a different point. Certainly in the way that we talk to our children, we talk to spouses, whether we talk to friends, as we communicate, as we talk with them, how do we begin that conversation? Is it with a sweetness when you call the person by name, wanted to say something to you? Or is it something else that's coming? And the way that we respond to those conversations is always entirely different in the way that we are addressed as it begins. And it's a tremendous lesson, as you'll put that in your back pocket as you go through life, to call somebody by their first name as you begin addressing them has a tremendous impact. The Rashi comments, it's a language of chiba, it's a dearness. People love hearing their own name being called. It's special. It actually means that you're directly communicating to me, the person. And it has an impact when we do things like that, and that's one of the first lessons, that's the first thing that Rashi comments in this parsha, and the whole Sefer is that idea. Just wanted to make note of that. Point number two that I just want to make before we go on to what we want to study this afternoon. The second Rashi makes the following point, following up on this point that we've just stated, that before Hashem addressed Moshe, Rashi said whenever he addressed him, whether or not it was a commandment, whether or not it was a conversation, whether or not it was an amira, a diba, whatever type of communication there was, it was always preceded with this kriya, so with this calling out. So Rashi comments in the second Rashi, he asks a question, Yochol, based on the sages, Yochol af lehafsakos haisa kriya. Maybe you would have thought that the spaces in between the words, the pauses, also had a kriya, also had a calling out. Meaning, if you'll just, as an example, flip the page to page 546, you'll notice that at the bottom of the page there's a paragraph break in the middle of the Hebrew section. That is actually in a Sefer Torah. The Chumash is reprinting the Chumash here, the text, the way it would appear in a Sefer Torah. There are pauses, there are spaces in the Sefer Torah. Next time you see a Hagbo and they pick up the Sefer Torah after it's read on Shabbos morning, go up to the front and look, and you'll see it's not a just like a book where it's a running text from the beginning of the right side of the column to the end of the left side of the column, straight way down. There are numerous pauses and breaks. The songs, for example, of Az Yashir and others are actually structured like a tower, you know, with the first line is on the opposite end, the next line is in the middle. There's a whole structure to that. So Rashi comments, well, if everything that Hashem said to Moshe had a kriya, before Hashem said it to Moshe, he called out and said, Moshe, Moshe, Moshe would respond, I'm here, and then Hashem would say something. Maybe even those little pauses before a pause, also you had a calling out, and Hashem said, Moshe, and he said, what? I'm here, I'm ready. And then he just let it be silent for a while, and then they would go on. So Rashi comments, you might have thought that's the case. However, it's not true because the Pasuk says, he called to Moses and Hashem spoke to him. Only when Hashem actually spoke did he precede his speaking with a calling out to Moshe. But those spaces in the Torah where there's nothing being said, he wasn't called before that. So Rashi then follows with the obvious question, well, what are those things doing there anyway then? If it wasn't some sort of communication, why are they there? Why do we have throughout the Torah these paragraph breaks in which there is blank space in a Sefer Torah? So Rashi comments with a statement of beauty. What were they doing there? What do they accomplish all of these spaces and breaks in the Torah? Litain revach leMoshe lehis bonein bein parsho leparsho bein inyan leinyan, to give a break, to give a pause, to give time to Moshe to contemplate that which was just said before moving on to the next topic, between this parsha and that parsha, between this topic and that topic, between this inyan and that inyan, this discussion and that discussion, you find breaks. Says Rashi, what was the purpose of those breaks? To allow Moshe the time to integrate the information that had just been said, that which he'd just been taught. Wait, think about it, internalize it, understand it, contemplate it, then we'll go on to the next. Concludes Rashi, Kal v'chomer, how much more so for a hedyot halome min ha-hedyot, to a regular person, like you and like me, learning from regular people, like you and like me. So that if Moshe, the greatest Jew who ever lived, on the greatest level of prophecy who ever lived, in communication with the greatest teacher who exists, God Himself, needed time to pause and integrate the information between one topic and another topic, so those little pauses are reminders to us when we're learning from little guys like me, we also need to let the information seep in. Hold on a second. Before going on to the next thing, let me make sure that I got it. Let me think about that. Let me contemplate that. Let me internalize that. And when I got it, then we can move on. But it's to note, the human mind doesn't work so fast that I can just sort of hear the information, got it, on to the next. It doesn't work that way. It takes a while to go from here, where we could understand it right away, till it like works its way down into the heart and into our essence of our being, where we can really act on it. As a takeoff of this, I want to share with you an idea that I recently read. I think its impact is just enormous. There's a term, I'm not sure if it was made up by a police department somewhere or by some author, something called white space. But the idea of the white space is what the police department refers to the amount of reaction time in the police force between when an incident happens and the reaction of a police officer. How much time do you have between once there's a problem and you have to react? So, for example, when they do the studies, when they look back at all the assassination attempts at Reagan or elsewhere, where there have been such events, how much time was there for the Secret Service to react from the time that somebody brandishes a gun until the whole thing is over is sometimes like 1.8 seconds. Like the whole thing, that's all that it took. So how much reaction time do you have in terms of figuring those things out, in terms of how you relate? So that's an example where there's almost no time. And they learn and they study these things, and that's how they put things into practice so that, for example, when a police officer stops a car, right?
I don't know. I've never had this before. I don't know what it is. I'll come back. Okay.
When a police officer stops a car or someone's speeding on the highway, so you'll notice that they stand behind them and they flash their lights over their shoulder and they approach from the behind. It's all because when they do that, if the guy in the front seat has a gun or something or is going to try to pull something, the amount of time it takes for him to turn around and get back, it just builds in few seconds, build in a couple of moments of time, and in that time, that difference is all the difference that we have to process information and come to a correct response. When as that time gets shortened, we don't react well because we don't have time to process all the human mind is an amazing apparatus, but it needs a little bit of time to process information and then for us to react in an appropriate manner. And they're always training their officers to build in as much time as possible. I read, in fact, that the police force is pushing towards one-man cars as opposed to two-man cars. Even though one would intuit it's safer to have a team in a car, to have two cops in a car as opposed to one, they found that it's not true. Because when you're two, they're much less cautious. They feel safe and protected in numbers, and they approach situations in a much more hurried, less careful and protected way because they feel safe. When you're by yourself in a car and you spot something suspicious, you're very careful. You wait for backup. You survey the scene. You stay from a distance for a while, and they've found less accidents and faulty reports and aren't taking that because they're more careful and they're building in that time where they don't act hastily. So I always find this Rashi to be an amazing insight. It's in all of our life is like that. We don't go through things like one thing and another, we get it. It doesn't work that way. There needs to be a pause. We're like building in literal white space in the Chumash, in the text. You just learn something. So just like when we react to things in life, we need a few minutes. Let me take it in. And process it. Sometimes it's literally just a few moments, 10 seconds, not a long time, but just to allow myself to survey the scene, take in the information, process, and come to a conclusion. So when Moshe Rabbeinu was learning all of these halachas, so it's not just in our intellectual capacity, it's in our emotional capacity. Like Hashem teaches something, there's a pause. Think about that. When it comes to information, the way that we react to things, the way we internalize things, takes time. So Moshe was given a little pause before we go on to the next thing. We're going to wait. We're going to let that seep in. Think about that. And then we'll go on. And it's a tremendous skill, not just in as we study, which is the source of this, is where Moshe is learning as he's studying things, he's doing that, but in all of our areas of life. I read in a book once on parenting that sometimes children do just the darndest things. And sometimes they do things that require and demand a response, an immediate response, because what was done is absolutely inappropriate. And they need to know now that what they did is inappropriate. But you, as a parent, have no idea what you're supposed to do. What in the world is the consequence for this? What in the world is the punishment? I know I need to react. I have no idea how. So I read it in one of his books. So that's what you need to do. You need to react immediately with, I don't know what we're going to do. We're going to talk about this later. Just because you're just buying yourself a few minutes. Instead of saying something ridiculous, like, you're never going to go outside again for the rest of your life, which has been known to be uttered by a frustrated parent in a moment of passion, which is absurd, yet we say things like that. If not that exactly, we'll say something like that, or we'll ask some ridiculous rhetorical question to a five-year-old, what were you thinking? What exactly do you want your five-year-old to answer you? I don't know, Mom. I was just sort of thinking it would be fun to try to burn the cat's tail off. Like that, there's no response to that question, but I need to respond because the child just did something either dangerous to themselves or to something else, or just it's inappropriate. So you need to react and then build yourself in that space. Don't force yourself to respond immediately. Build in, we're going to have to talk about this. We'll talk about it later. Or when your father comes home. Or when I need to think about it. Or just say something that buys time so that you can process it. And it's not just with parenting, it's with all things. You know, I get there all the time with emails or phone calls from angry Karen. I don't know what to say. So you just respond. Just build in that time, that revach, bein parsha leparsha, that space between one. Just think about that. Let me relax. I can't deal with it right away. It's just too much. So, I'm veering a little bit. The direct source is in learning, processing information. But I think it's all the same. Just like when you process information of what Hashem is teaching Moshe, it needs to be processed. All of life is like that. The information we take in needs to be processed. There needs to be a little bit of time before we immediately react and jump into something. Because if I go into the next thing, I didn't get this one yet. And I'm doing this already. And I haven't gotten it yet. It's just build in a little bit of that white space. And you could always refer to this Rashi as saying, I'm just not ready for that yet. I need the time and the space to allow that to seep in and to get my bearings as to how I want to proceed from here. Do you have a comment?
Yeah, I was just watching a night show 30 years ago. Maury Amsterdam was being interviewed. And he says that he tutored Kennedy when he went to debate Nixon. And one of the best tricks he taught him was when he asked a question that he didn't like, he should say, I'm glad you asked that question, which would give him enough time to think of the answer. And that's why he made Nixon look so bad. Nixon was reaching and Kennedy came right out with, glad you asked that question.
Right, and even in saying that, that just gives you, literally, what's that, 2 seconds, 3 seconds? But that's all the difference, because our minds, we do think extremely fast. But the first thought's not always the best thought. But the second or third thought is sometimes a lot better. And the only difference between blurting out your first thought and your second or third is a statement like that.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you asked the question. Let me just think about that. That's all it takes. And it's just building in a little bit of space. And we have the source from Rashi that as human beings, we need that. The greatest of prophets needed a little bit of time to integrate the information that he was receiving from the greatest of teachers before he can move on. Otherwise, it's lost. I need a little bit of that space. And it's a great little tool. You know, any time, it's your tool in life. Anytime anyone tries to pressure you into doing something, you know right away you don't want to be involved in it. Salesman at a store, anytime you have to make a decision right away, and then I can't think about it. I can't make a decision like that. And if you're not comfortable with my thinking about this, then I'm not comfortable being involved in this. Anytime you're in a store and it's like that, I'm gonna call you back tomorrow. No, you need to know today. If you're not comfortable with my thinking about this for a day, then I don't think that you're selling a product that you trust or that I'm comfortable buying. Because why can't I think about it? You know, that's their job as a salesman to think about it. But if they're like, they don't want you to think about it. So that's a general rule, of pushy salesmen.
Especially car
salesman. All right. Those are just two introductory comments. And most of this parsha, you can flip through the headings over Shabbos as you go through. It deals with all different types of sacrifices, the circumstances in which they are offered, and the general rules as to the process as to how they are offered. I'd like to focus on page 550, if you'll just flip just a few pages. There is a interesting series of laws that are thrown in here in the midst of all of these laws of the general types of sacrifices that are brought as to the types of sacrifices that are not allowed. That has to do with chametz. Chametz, leavened products, yeast products, honey-type products are all forbidden for use to be placed on the Mizbeach. On the altar in the Beis HaMikdash, there were all sorts of different sacrifices offered. Aside for the animal sacrifices which were offered, there were various meal offering sacrifices which were offered. Meal offerings were brought, again, under specific circumstances, a whole different series of them. Flour was brought by the individual Jew, or a priest who had to bring it for himself, was brought to the altar, and the Kohen would go through a process in which he would scoop out part of that flour. Sometimes it was mixed with oil, sometimes it wasn't mixed with oil, sometimes it was baked into matzah, sometimes it was baked into loaves, sometimes it was baked into figure, all different types of pans that were used to bake some of the flour. Some of it was then sprinkled on the altar, some of it was baked and eaten, some of it was baked and burned. A whole series of different types of offerings with flour, meal offerings. Whenever those were brought together with the sacrifices, so there was a prohibition of having any of that flour become chametz. It was not allowed to leaven. It was not allowed to become what we would classify as chametz, as far as we're getting ready. Pesach is coming right around the corner, 5 weeks. So already talking chametz. So if I say that enough times, there's not going to be a single woman here next week. I know already. Time to get ready.
6 weeks after Purim.
Yeah. No, it's 4 weeks after Purim. Always 4 weeks after Purim. Yeah. 6 weeks from Rosh Chodesh Adar, 4 weeks from Purim. So it's coming around the corner. So when you brought them onto the altar, they would not have to become chametz. So the verse for this is in Pasuk Yud Aleph, verse 11. Pasuk says, Kol ha-mincha asher takrivu la-Hashem, any meal offering that you offer up to Hashem, lo se'aseh chametz. You're not allowed to prepare it leavened. It's not allowed to be chametz. Anything which you would not be allowed to have in your home on Pesach, you're not allowed to allow this meal offering to become chametz. Why? Ki chol se'or v'chol devash lo yisaktiru mimenu ishela Hashem. Any leavening or fruit, honey, a fruit-type product, a honey-type product, or the sweets, all of those were not allowed to be offered as a fire offering to Hashem. Those things not to be placed on the Mizbeach. And were therefore forbidden. So the Torah throws into the conclusion, if you see in the top half of the page, you have all, what's going on in this area of the Torah, all the different types of fine flour offerings, the oven-baked, or the pan-baked, the deep-pan offering, all the different things. And at the end of that series of halachas discussing those types of meal offerings, the Torah says, none of them are ever allowed to become chametz, and none of them are ever allowed to be brought with a honey or fruit-like substance. One exception is in verse 12, Pasuk Yud Beis. Korban reishis takrivu osam la'Hashem. However, you shall offer them as a first fruit offering to Hashem. V'yal ha-mizbeach lo yadu l'reach nechach. They are not allowed to go onto the altar. So what is that a reference to, that the one exception is as a first fruit offering to Hashem, they are allowed to go? So that is a reference to the karbonos, the offerings which are brought during Shavuos, the Bikurim, which are brought throughout the year at the beginning of the crops, when a person has the first of his crops are brought. And on Shavuos, the two loaves, there was a type of korban which was brought out of two loaves, which was a public offering. It wasn't an individual bringing it, but on behalf of the Jewish people, two loaves were offered in the Mizbeach, two baked breads. And that is the only exception, the Bikurim and the two loaves of Shavuos, to this rule where you are otherwise not allowed to bring chametz and not allowed to bring any fruit or honey product onto the Mizbeach. That is all the Torah has to say with it. From here, the Torah goes on to the covenant of salt, which I believe we spoke about last year, if I remember correctly. The concept is another mitzvah that every korban that's brought has to have salt brought with it. One of the references we have to the fact that we have salt on our tables as well is a remnant of that, which is Rashi quotes back from the beginning of creation, with the lower waters, the waters of the heavens were split into two. The upper waters became the upper waters, whatever exactly that means, and the lower waters were sent down here to form the oceans and the rivers of what we have down here. And the lower waters were complaining that they were separated from the upper waters in the higher worlds, and so Hashem basically appeased them by saying that you too will have a place in the service of the Beis HaMikdash, both in the Nisuch HaMayim, where the water was poured during Sukkos, and the salt, which is where the remnants of the evaporated water was used in every single karban. There was salt brought onto the Mizbeach as well. That's a whole other discussion. We're not going to get into that today. So what's with this idea of the chametz and of the honey, the fruit-type offerings? Why are those not permitted in the Beis HaMikdash? What is the idea behind that? So Sefer HaChinuch, I believe we've quoted in the past, is written by one of the Rishonim, goes through each one of the 613 mitzvahs of the Torah. He basically follows the count that Maimonides came up with. The Rambam listed the 613 mitzvahs, and he basically follows the count of the Rambam. And he goes through each one, and he gives a little detail, a brief synopsis of what the mitzvah is about, who it applies to, when it is fulfilled, a short description of the halachas about the mitzvahs, and then what he does, and this is his unique contribution to those who count up the mitzvahs, he offers a shoresh, he offers a reason behind the mitzvah. Now, he states clearly in his introduction, we don't really know the reasons behind the mitzvahs. We don't know, he doesn't know, he's not telling you exactly why these things are done. But his point is, as the name of his book is called the Sefer HaChinuch, which he wrote for children to give them something to latch onto, some understanding, some meaning behind the mitzvahs as to what it is that we can gain as we fulfill them. So whether or not, he says, what I suggest is the reason behind this may or may not be true, I don't know for sure, but we certainly can take these lessons home with us. These are things that we can use to adapt and to grow from, regardless. This is what the commandment is. And when you do this, it benefits you, or people, or the Jewish people, human beings, in this way. Therefore, he gives a suggestion as to why it would be that Hashem would have commanded us to do this. And he goes through all that. So when he gets to these mitzvahs of the prohibition of any leavened product, of having chametz on the mizbeach, or of having honey on the mizbeach, so he writes, Shorshe mitzvah zu ne'elomim me'od limtso afilu remez katan mehem. This particular prohibition of chametz and of yeast and of honey says it's entirely hidden from me, even to find the smallest hint of why it would be that Hashem would say, you can't have chametz on my mizbeach. Can't bring honey. Can't bring fruit. I have no idea. Now, he wrote 3 volumes. He found reasons for every other mitzvah. This particular mitzvah, he says, I really don't know. I don't understand what the significance is that on the altar of Hashem, you can't bring chametz. Ulam. Nonetheless. Even though he does not give that type of introduction for most of the mitzvahs. He doesn't say, I don't really... And that's his general understanding. And he says, well, he suggests here and there. In this particular case, he says, Ulam, let me suggest some things as just to help one's mind to try to understand exactly what this is about. So he says as follows, in Yonei HaKarbon, what's the point of a karbon? What's the point? We're starting Sefer Vayikra. Every time you start Sefer Vayikra, we get into the book of the sacrifices. The discussion always needs to eventually circle around to what's the point? What do we accomplish with the sacrifices? So besides getting into the nitty-gritty, he says the idea is la'orer machsheves hamakrav. It's to arouse the thought processes, the intentions, the feelings of he who is bringing his sacrifice. Your goal, we really can't appreciate this because we don't have a Beis HaMikdash and we never brought a sacrifice. Not only have we never brought a sacrifice, we've probably never really come that close to a real live cow all that many times in our life. Go to a zoo, they don't have cows in a zoo. It's a petting zoo. When have you really come face to face with a cow or a bull or a sheep or a goat? So the experience of taking one of your own animals that you've raised and that you've taken out of your flock and you take it and you walk it up to Yerushalayim, you didn't necessarily live in Yerushalayim. You may have lived, 10, 15, 40 miles away. You schlep this animal all the way, whether or not they were walking or in a wagon or somehow they get the animal to Yerushalayim and you approach it based on Mikdash and you have your little Betsy that you've been nurturing all these years that's given you milk and other children and all the other, and you finally, you have your animal and you're ready to give it over to the karbon, and there's a process where you put your hands on it and it's slaughtered in front of you. It's gruesome to us. It's beyond our real understanding of what it's like. But apparently, from those who experienced it, it was the experience of having your animal brought to the Mizbeach. Now, you have to remember also what it's like to be in a Beis HaMikdash. Part of the fact that we can't grasp what it's like is the fact that we don't know what a Beis HaMikdash is like. We don't know what it's like to have a place where you go and you can sense and feel the divine presence. We don't get that. So we're missing every element of what it was like experientially to bring a sacrifice. We're missing the whole thing from start to finish. So it makes sense that we look at a little askance and we're like, I don't know, I don't get it. That's fair. We don't get it because we have no experience on any level. We don't own animals, so we don't know what it's like to give up an animal. We don't have a Beis HaMikdash. We don't know, like, watching an animal be slaughtered is this gruesome thing, and a kohen and sprinkling the blood there, and then you go eat part of the animal. It's like the whole thing is just beyond us. But with that little introduction, what happened to the Jew who went through that experience of giving up something of tremendous value of his in the Beis HaMikdash, and having it been offered on the Mizbeach, the Ramban uses the language where a person almost got the sense where he himself had been atoned for, he himself had been offered, it was as if his blood had been spilled, and he's now fresh and clean and brought close. The root of the word karban is karov, which means close. That somehow the idea of the sacrifice would bring one closer to Hashem. So says the Sefer Achina, since the whole point was the orir machsheva samakrev, somehow the process was such that the person who gave the sacrifice, who brought his animal in, was somehow aroused. He was inspired. He left the Beis HaMikdash not nauseous over what had taken place. He left it inspired. He felt somehow moved. He felt closer to his spiritual side, to being in communication more directly with his Creator. So therefore, he was told to leave chametz out of the equation. Leave chametz out. Because what does chametz represent? As we always hear over and over again, Pesach time, what is chametz all about? So chametz is all about shehiyah. It's all about waiting. Time. Passage of time. Time goes by. And that's why the difference between right matzah and chametz is only the amount of time it took. Matzah is the same ingredients baked quickly, and chametz are those same ingredients baked with a little bit more time. So the lesson that says the Sefer Achinuch, Yikach, Dimyon, Liknos, Midos, Hazrizus, person needs to acquire the trait of alacrity, to do things speedily, quickly, when an opportunity presents itself, so you don't sit on it, you jump into it. V'hakalos, Mihiros, it should be fast. In the Maisei Hashem Yisbarach, as the mission of those says, Havikal, Kinesha, Ratz, Ketzvi, Gibor, Kari, you have to be light as a eagle and run like a deer, strong like a lion to fulfill the will of Hashem, Yeratzon of our Father in Heaven. Chametz is all about affluence and wealth and taking your time and being deliberate and slow with things. And as much as we started this afternoon by saying that when things react quickly, you need to build in a little bit of time, 100%. When it comes to the service of Hashem, you need to have a lightness to yourself. And he's saying, yeah, it's a good idea. I really should get to shul on time. Next week I'll start. Yeah, it's a nice idea. I'll try this. Maybe. That attitude, that's a chametz attitude. That's an attitude of sitting around, of letting things just sort of sit, and they're not fresh. They've become old and stale. And so one of the lessons, he says, a rem is a hint that I can find as to part of the reason why the Torah would forbid us from bringing any chametz on the Mizbeach, is to inculcate within us an idea that you need to be quick with things. So he explains, I want to give a second explanation of this in a minute. So why is it that on Shavuos we're allowed to bring the two loaves of bread which are made of chametz? What's the difference between the individual throughout the year who's prohibited from engaging in chametz-like behavior in the Beis HaMikdash and a group and Shavuos where we do bring the two loaves? So he writes, Lachinach, that the difference is that the individual, between an individual sacrifice offering versus a communal offering. The two loaves that are offered on Shavuos are not brought by every individual. Every individual does not bake two loaves and bring them to the Beis HaMikdash. The Kohanim break two loaves on behalf of the Jewish people. And the two loaves are there, and whatever is done with them is done with them. So the Chinuch suggests that's the difference. When it comes to an individual, you yourself need to be on top of things. You yourself need to be light-footed and ready to jump into any opportunity you have for spiritual growth and grab it by the horns and take it when it presents itself. When you're in a group, there the Torah relaxes the prohibition on chametz, because in a group, the group will take care of itself. The group will, within itself, someone in the group will, you know, egg everybody on, will prod them forward, will keep things going. So then in a group, he suggests there's less fear that things will stagnate, because in any group setting, you always have that guy, that gal, somebody who's going to, come on, we need to, let's keep it moving, we got to be doing this, we got to be doing that. So he suggests that the difference between the two loaves on Shavuos and the prohibition throughout the rest of the year is simply from that, that one is a communal offering, and within a group you have people who will always inspire others, but when it comes to the individual, you need to get up off your seat by yourself. What about the dvash? What about the concept of the honey, the prohibition to put honey or fruits on the table? So the Chinuch suggests, again, this is in order to teach us that a person needs to be yimayid ha'odom ilirdof achar ha'ma'acholim ha'mesukim l'chon ha'mesukim. A person needs to limit pursuit of those sweet and fanciful foods, because to teach that what a person needs to focus on is that which they need, as opposed to the extraneous things which are above and beyond that which is necessary. A person certainly needs things, but by not bringing honey or fruits into the Beis HaMikdash, or the fruit honey, is to say, this is a place of spiritual growth. And in spiritual growth, certainly you need to eat, the food is absolutely essential, but there's in the language that he uses, and it's not even a language of avoiding forever sweet stuff, he avoids the pursuit of the sweets. When you're in pursuit of the extraneous things, that, he says, is the lesson that you need to sort of step back from and take from the fact that the Beis HaMikdash, I can't bring these things in order not to get too engrossed in them. And then he concludes with a final thought that Seor and Devash, leavening products, cause things to expand. When you put yeast in dough, so that's the difference between your matzah and your cracker and your pretzel and your challah. And you let it sit, and it causes things to rise. So he writes a beautiful idea. Another idea, he says, why the Torah would not allow us to have chametz in the Beis HaMikdash is because of that idea. Ki toyevas Hashem kol gvat leiv, because it is abominable to Hashem all haughty hearts amongst the Jewish people. So just like a person who in his own image of himself begins to get bloated and expanding, and his chest seems to be puffing out more, and his chin gets a little bit raised, that is the activity of Seor. That is the same impact that yeast has on dough, which it causes it to rise up and expand and grow out. So Hashem says, not in my house. Not in my house. In my Mizbeah, we don't have any of that here. Because the only, in my house, a person comes to the recognition of humility, comes to recognition of, it's not my strength and my talents which are accomplishing it. The greatest place to come to that recognition is in the Beis HaMikdash itself, on the Mizbeach, that it is Hashem who gives us the strength and the talents to be able to do those things, and therefore that leavening agent which causes the dough to puff up and swell is that which he does not want, and therefore there's no chametz allowed in the Beis HaMikdash. A third explanation that he gives, he quotes from the Ramban, as follows. Leavening agents have the ability to change the nature of things. It takes things and it manipulates it. It's one of those things that we have many things like that in the world, in which man has the ability to take certain natural tools, certain things which exist in the world, and to use them and to manipulate them to create. The ability to create the challah, to change the dough from the form that it's in into the form that we use to break, comes from that yeast. So the Ramban suggests that when we step into Hashem's house, in which we are recognizing Hashem as the manipulator of the world, Hashem is the one who's given us those tools, we come plain and simple. We come just the flour and the water, baked into non-chametz, flat bread, matzahs, whatever it's baked in, but it doesn't have that ability to develop into a more of a rich or luscious loaf of bread. It's just the plain, simple ingredients. That's what we offer to Hashem in the Beis HaMikdash, is a recognition that all of those tools that He's given us to control the world, and we do have those tools. What distinguishes us as intelligent man is our ability to manipulate the world, to take a field which is overgrown and weed it, plow it, harvest, and we can create like that. The animal world has not figured that out. That's the intellect of man, our ability to manipulate the world that we have. But when we come to the base of Mikdash, we come without that. We come with the simplest of ingredients without any of those items. That's the suggestion. Those are three suggestions that he makes as to why we have the prohibition of chametz in the Beis HaMikdash, and why that would be inappropriate. Either, again, to inspire us to alacrity, to zrizus, to move quickly, not to allow that element of the chametz, or the fact that it expands the dough, the yeast, and causes it a representation of the haughty of heart, or because, as the Ramban suggests, because of its ability to change the nature of the dough into something that looks distinctly different, so therefore all of those things are limited out. That's what the Sefer HaChinuch writes. I wanted to share with you one last thought from the Kli Yakar. The Kli Yakar is one of the classic commentaries on the Chumash, who also takes up this issue as to why it should be that we're not allowed to bring chametz into the Beis HaMikdash, just a prohibition. And with the only exception coming on Shavuos, where we do bring the Shtei Halach, and we do bring those two loaves. So he writes the following idea. Seor, yeast, and devash represent the desires and the taivas, the yearnings that we have for physical pleasures in the world. Seor, yeast, is used that way often in the statements of Chazal. There's a lot of Pesach Torah that you hear all has that idea. That's part of the reason the crushing of the Yetzirah, the yeast, which adds that lusciousness and the richness to the bread. There's a statement that the sages make, in which the Jewish people, basically, in which they represent the Jewish people, saying, "Goloi lefanecha, it is known before you, O Hashem, our King, sheritzoneinu la'asos ritzonecha, that really our desire is to fulfill your will. It's known before you know that really, really, that's what we want to do. Ela shebesaor shebo isa ma'akevis, but it's the yeast in the dough which is preventing us from doing it." Reference to the Yetzirah, that it's a prayer on behalf of the Jew. Really, you know, we want to do the right thing. We really do. But that yeast in the dough, that's what's stopping us. It's that Yetzirah, which is causing us to deviate, to stray, to not be able to get done we want to do, but really inside we want to. So you have the reference that the sages use to that yeast in the dough, that's the problem for that, and the dvash, the honey, the sweetness, certainly he says is a representation, says the Kli Yakar, to the idea of a man's desire and drive for pleasurable things. So he writes, now it is certainly true that all those things, physical pleasures and physical needs, are all necessary. One could not live without them, but they are all only means to an end. They are only there used for a person to accomplish what he really needs, which is his spiritual pursuits, his pursuits of Torah, and fulfilling all of the mitzvahs. And therefore he writes, throughout the year, a person to bring an offering that's made solely, purely, only of chametz, only of the honey or the fruits, would be inappropriate. Because to make it an end unto itself, where this is my offering, would be inappropriate. It's not something that's done. When is the one time that we bring it? Reishis bikure. The language of the Chumash was in your first offering. When it comes to Shavuos, your first offering of your fruits, or Shavuos time, we bring the loaves. What's unique about Shavuos time that we would be able to bring the loaves at that particular time? Shavuos time is the time when the Torah was given. So specifically at that time, when the Torah is given, when we have the tools given to us to be able to take all of the physical pleasures in the world and be able to use it in an appropriate manner, that's the one time a year, together with the giving of the Torah and the beginning of that process, there we can take all of those agents that we use for the pleasurable experiences throughout the year, and they were able to use it, bring it unto the Mizbeach, together with that time of year of the giving of the Torah, to bring it into an appropriate usage, and then that sort of like carries you then through the year. Then in the beginning you have to have, he writes, the main kemach ein Torah, if you don't have what to eat, and you can't learn either. So in the starting process, yeah, we have all the things that we need. I have all the pleasures, I have all the food, I have all the sweets. At the time that the Torah is given, I take that and then I use that. But then throughout the year, as it ends unto itself, I'm not allowed to bring those things. It can only be brought specifically during that part, or during that time of year. In conjunction with the giving of the Torah, the using of the physical in a spiritual way, which is what the Torah teaches us, at that time we use it, but not otherwise. But that is some thoughts, various thoughts. Whenever you see so many different ideas behind something, it says that, like, that's always tells you that there's nothing that clear, this is what it is. Lots of options. But the Torah does have those prohibitions on offering honey, fruits, chametz, all of those things are forbidden from the Mizbeach, except for those, except for the Bikurim, your first fruits, which are brought to the Mizbeach, and during Shavuos, where the two loaves are baked. But other than that, those things are prohibited.